And then also, speaking of launch prep, we sent out a dope PR email, which Sam was particularly proud of and just wanted to
share. Yeah, I think I peaked in terms of subject lines, which we ran some
peak,
stats.
Peak dope.
Scotch. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 243 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I'm moving air out of my mouth.
I'm Sam, and my back hurts.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is January 24th, 2020. Before we get started, we have some great news. We're going to be swearing on this show.
All the time.
Hooray.
So put a smile on that face, because it's happening. Also... we'd like to thank our supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. We got a donation from Specchio, who says, "This is for Seth to buy a pack of Gatorade so he can power through a whole 12 lines of code next time." So there was an exchange in the Discord where I believe it was Specchio asked, he's like, "Can we have this thing happen?" And I was
doesn't
like,
he just isn't that how he
when has he ever not?
Yeah. Yeah. And he was like, he's like, "It would really be nice if I could do this." And I popped open that section of the code and I was like, "Oh, I mean, I could just like add an if statement to that."
Hmm.
So it was one line. So I did. And I was like, "Oh my God, I'm exhausted. I'm going to need some Gatorade after that." So he came through.
Well, this is actually a funny thing. It does happen with some regularity, which is we'll talk to Seth about something. Be like, "Hey, like, I, you know, I don't want to bother." This actually literally happened yesterday. I was working on a problem with the checkpoints and the cameras and Levelhead. Thing I finally noticed after hundreds of hours of building stuff. And I was like, "Hey, yeah, this is probably like a huge thing. Can you try to make it work like this instead of the way it currently works?" And we talked about it for maybe 30 seconds. And then I walked back to my desk and literally like a minute later, so it's like, "Oh, yeah, it's done."
What?
I've been sitting here for a year not the, having this.
This is honestly what makes it, I think, so hard to...
to choose where to spend your time.
Yeah.
Well, not only, you can do infinite stuff.
Not really only that, fast. But it's hard to even like as a person suggesting changes or requesting new features or whatever, you have no concept of what would be easy or hard to do.
That's true.
Right. And so some things that might sound unreasonably ludicrous or because they might you might be like, "Oh, maybe this is using some kind of like hidden complicated mechanism that I don't understand," and it turns out it's an if statement, you know. Then another thing that sounds really simple, like, "It'd be cool if when I dragged a path node, if the item attached to it went with it." And that's a week. That's a week of that's a week of refactoring.
And it is more likely that a simple thing is hard.
Yes.
As in like that is the kind of thing that we get both that we give to each other for feedback, but also that we get from outside where someone just says, "Could you just," which is, when we talked about this in an episode long ago.
The word just.
We said there was going to be profanity on this episode.
Yeah. This is the worst.
Just is the worst
it's
one.
It's the most profane word
it's
there
disgusting.
Is.
Disgusting. You disgust me. Keep that word out your mouth.
Yeah. Why don't we just add this? Why don't we just do that? 6 months later. Oh, God.
But another consideration, consideration here too, though, is and something that's – especially when people know this, when somebody knows, "Oh yeah, Seth can fix a whole bunch of stuff in mere seconds or minutes," right? Mm-hmm. Then it always begs the question of, well, why doesn't he just fix this like laundry list of all of the things or make these like little minor tweaks that would make the game a little bit better and all this kind of stuff, right? And it's because, yeah, he can do all of that, but there's infinite of them.
Yep. And every time, everything
we've talked about how things move, right? So like you'll solve this new thing. Someone's like, "Oh, I just 5 minute tweak here." And the reality is it doesn't actually solve anything.
Well,
just moves the problem.
Yeah, and honestly, fixing something only creates more demand. So because it's the Jevons paradox, right? So we added a ruler to Levelhead last week. It's a grid ruler, and you can turn it on in the editor settings, and it's a cool little thing where it's like it'll count how many grid spaces you've moved your cursor through, and so you can like use it to measure things. You can use it to count how many blocks you've placed. Mm-hmm. You can also use it to see where you're at. So if you're like, "Oh, my level is 50 wide and I'm at 25, so I'm in the middle," right? So you can now do that stuff that was literally impossible to do before. So you think, cool, problem solved.
Great, new feature.
Right? No. This is the start of a whole new set of problems.
Yeah.
Because now that people can do this thing, which is like see the ruler, they can measure blocks, whatever, now all of a sudden – it's requests for it measuring other things, you know, or measuring certain things differently, or it displaying
like, "How am I feeling today, ruler?
Yeah,
tell me, measure my feeling."
And so, I think it's an interesting lesson that I personally have had to like really sort of like emotionally grapple with over the course of early access is I literally can't solve problems.
No, you can only create more.
That's true.
Yeah. And by solving a problem, you only make more work for yourself later. Yeah.
What it is, and it's funny too for me coming from the outside of having anything to do with any of the feature implementation of the game. Every time Sam and Seth are pumped about some new thing, they got in there like, oh, I can't wait to get this in players' hands. And then it finally gets into players' hands. The only thing that happens is people start asking for changes to it and additions to it and whatever.
Yeah.
There's every once in a while, like there's this rare moment where someone's like, oh, thanks.
This is great. I love this. I love the this. End.
Yeah.
That's yeah. It. The end. I've said what I wanted to say.
I know. It's just universally, why not this way? Why did you decide to do it like this?
Now, I want to say, like, this isn't a complaint that we have.
It's a fact.
It's
just a fact.
Yeah. It's a fact about humans is like we generate ideas based on what is there.
Yeah, you get input and you put output.
Yeah, and so when there's a new thing there, you get new ideas. That's just how it works.
But it's something that as a developer, whether it's for games or anything, or just a person making creative content at all, mm-hmm. right? The moment you put your thing in front of other people, you have to be ready for that reality, right? Because the reality that we all want is when we make something awesome and somebody's really excited about the awesome thing that we made, and that's the relationship, right?
Yep, that's it.
But that is not the relationship that human beings have with the things that they consume at all.
Yeah. The thing about humans is it's never enough.
It's never enough.
You can always think of something.
Well, you got that hope. You know, you get that huge hole.
You get that void in your soul.
Get the void in your soul. It's just
– yeah.
We're all just trying to fill our soul void.
I was actually – somebody posted a video in the Discord just this morning about the mathematics of the just noticeable difference and how if you're holding 100 grams in your hand, like 100 gram weight, and somebody puts 120 gram weight in your other hand, you can tell which one's heavier. But if it's 200 grams and 220, you can't tell, right? So, if something is 20% more, you're like, oh, yeah, obviously. But if it's 10% more, then you have no clue.
But also depends on how relatively strong your two arms are.
That's true. So, if one of them is 20% stronger,
then it's going to feel the same.
It's going to take more. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's, people always operate on relative terms. And we talked about, like last week, we talked about how you can't tell how warm things are. You can only tell whether they are warmer or colder than your hand.
Yep. But, I mean, it's an important note, I think, as you're developing or making anything, which is that the minute you put it in front of people, there will be a large reaction that will try to direct your energies. That's just how it's going to be.
Yeah.
Right?
And you gotta be ready to know how you're going to deal with
it. Yes, because it's good. It can be very good in terms of being like, oh, we actually didn't need to spend any time on X, Y, or Z because people really care about this thing. It's kind of a surprise and we need to buff that up. But it's important to recognize that any feature you have in there, people are going to want
know because if you had spent time on X, Y, or Z, then maybe that's the thing people would be talking about. And also, literally any of those could make for a good game. You don't know.
But from an emotional perspective of being the person who made the thing, it's that you have to switch from believing that when someone's excited, that's their show of – that they love the thing, to the fact that they want it to be different is actually the marker that they're really into the thing because it's important to them. They want it to be in just like a certain way. They feel like they understand it deeply.
I would say it's more like the volume of discussion about how to modify a new thing we put in level head typically is actually the indicator of how successful the thing it is.
Yeah, I think that's true. Right.
Yeah. Well, with some exceptions. So I want to talk about multi-select.
Yeah. Go for it.
Well, okay. So we got multi-select into the game and this tool – is so powerful. What you can do is you can select any shape of thing. You can select up to something like 1,300 or 1,400 blocks at a time.
And then copy and paste them.
You can copy them. You can paste them. You can delete them. You can drag them around. The stuff that you had to do in the past to execute these kinds of moves would be like hours of work that you could now do in a minute or a second, right? Mm-hmm. And so the process improvement is massive and it's speeding up level building and it's a huge quality of life improvement for everybody. So Sam, you've been building tons of levels.
Oh yeah.
And it's a lifesaver.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, the reality is a lot of the campaign levels, if at some point I was like, oh God, it would just be so good if I could move literally this whole section of the level down one tile, which oftentimes like weirdly enough, one tile makes a huge difference for like the playability of some levels. And usually I would just be like, I just need to change the rest of it, I guess, as I go to like somehow compensate for that.
And the interesting thing about I view multi-select as one of the biggest features that we've added, both in terms of how much work it took to get in and also in terms of how much it affects the level editor experience.
Yeah, I would say it is the biggest feature we've added during early access.
Like Paint Bucket was dope. Don't get me wrong. But multi-select is a game changer. Yeah. But interestingly, so like we put out the multi-select patch and people just started using multi-select, and it sort of like immediately became just like an automatic ingrained part of the workflow of building levels, mm-hmm. to the point where people saw it at the beginning, like, oh, this is great. And then that was this is it.
Yep.
because it kind of becomes like any of those, like you never hear people talking about the paint bucket.
Correct.
But people use it constantly as mm-hmm. they're building levels.
And any one of us can sit down and think of like 1,000 little ways to change both of these things. Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's also the case that like there are certain other things that are just that are much more annoying to work with, like the path editor, which clearly needs a bunch of updates. And so like obviously people are going to direct their energies right. toward like talking about those things. But sometimes
once you fix those things, maybe they'll start directing them towards multi-select.
Yeah. Possibly. But it's like sometimes you get a thing in there where it's just like it's so smooth and it just does exactly what it needs to do.
Yeah.
And it's just like – yes.
Well, I think it's
no
also
more questions. Yeah,
right. But yeah. They're also – these are kind of conceptually simple things, right? Because like the paint bucket is like, oh, it fills up a space, you know? And like multi-select, oh, you select a bunch of things, mm-hmm. right? It may just be that – because they're also – I mean, which makes them sound simple, but to execute those is enormously challenging, yeah. right? But the outcome as you perceive the experience mm-hmm. as a player is very simple, right? And so I wonder if it's actually just because – and it's not only simple, but it's also not even metaphorically like other things that people have used, but literally the same thing people have access to right. in the programs, right? So that – and it does exactly the same thing here as it does it in those other things. Expect. And so I think because it's not a new thing conceptually, it's just like, yeah. oh yeah, multi-select. You just select a bunch of things, right? People don't even think to start asking the question of – because they already know what to expect and they got what they expected.
It does what it does.
That's it.
It's kind of like if, you know, when you press enter in a word processor and it starts a new line, you're like, yeah.
Yep.
That's what that's yeah, supposed right, to yeah, do. Yeah. I have no more questions or concerns about this. uh-huh. So every now and then we go. So multi-select is in.
About once every 2 years, I think is about the rate. But
then something happens yep. and then yep. it's just settled.
Seems like it.
So that's in that patch. And honestly, like that was pretty much the whole patch. We had a couple of other small things. We had the grid ruler and a couple of smaller features, but almost all the time went into multi-select. Worth it.
A lot.
And before we go on to talk more about level head stuff, we do need to talk about the snowstorm and the ensuing weekend mm-hmm. and what happened. So for starters, there wasn't one.
Yeah. So
the snowstorm.
Yeah. We recorded early last Thursday.
Yeah.
So that we could – so just in case, because Friday was supposed to be just covered in ice.
Yep.
Nothing happened. It was totally fine.
It did
in the evening, basically.
Yeah, I think what happened was about 5 p.m., a single snowflake just kind of went – shot out from the sky.
Well, yeah. So it was basically, one person. It was raining all day, but it was basically 33 degrees.
Yeah, so it was just fine.
And so around 10, maybe like 9 or 10 is when it finally got cold enough that it was freezing on stuff. But the roads were actually somehow both either salted or hot. Hot enough.
The roads are black, so they kind of like soak mm-hmm. up a little bit more.
And the water also just got soaked into things by the time it got cold enough yeah. to matter.
And so the roads were just fine. But I went to a friend's birthday party, and this is where my tragedy of the weekend began.
Mm-hmm.
At this birthday party, as I was leaving, actually, about 10:30, I hopped my car, driving out of his driveway, and I'm like, this looks different than it did when I drove in.
Thanks to your LASIK.
Yes. I could see in front of me.
Yep.
And what I saw was a tree that had fallen down and completely obstructed the driveway. Just like
also, it was hard to see, but
the way that you're telling this is I'm imagining you like looking at this giant fucking tree laying across the driveway and being like, something has changed.
I like the idea that something can have changed so much that the confusion becomes so deep.
That's actually what
that
it
you
is.
You don't even realize.
I mean, you've seen those videos where like people look at something that clearly is like completely out of whack, and there's not a lot of response immediately because there's this sort of like
just too surprising.
You ever see the ones where somebody walks up to somebody and they'll be like, "Hey, I was wondering if you could like point me in the right direction."
And they swap,
and
the
then
person.
They change the person asking the question, and the answerer has no.
Oftentimes doesn't even notice.
Well, and here's the thing. I bet they notice every time. But
they
the
don't
mind
trust
fuck
themselves.
Is
yeah, yeah.
so deep. Where you like you look up and you're like, I mean, that can't be.
Yeah.
Well, so this is the experience.
You're not going to say it, though,
I'm
right?
clearly misremembering.
Yeah, you're not going to be like, were you just a different
were
person?
Were you a 6'8" man with a beard yeah. and now you're a 5-foot-tall elderly woman? Something has changed.
Yeah. So anyways, I drive up to the end of this driveway. Very confused, realize there's a tree in the way. Makes sense. That's why the road stops. And then call my friend. I was like, hey, there's a tree blocking your entire driveway. I can't go home. He starts cracking up. And then the whole birthday party comes outside you know, somewhat inebriated, gets a bunch of saws and things, and then we just proceed to dismantle this tree in barbaric fashion.
Now, hold on. How many saws?
There were two saws.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay. I was like, it would be weird. if this friend of yours had just enough saws just laying around in his house. I got 30 saws.
Unless this was a, you know, like a saw celebration party. They were party favors.
Mm-hmm. It's a saw themed birthday.
Perfect opportunity. Yeah. So everybody pours out of the house. We start just tearing apart this tree. And I mean, literally tearing it apart. So it's coated in ice. And so it weighs an extra bajillion pounds because of how those work. And so
– so you got to pulverize it.
Yeah. Basically, there's two people sawing at stuff. And then everyone else is just grabbing branches and just snapping them off with
force. I mean, we've all seen movies. When you freeze things, they're really brittle.
Honestly, I saw Terminator.
That's what happened.
Did you try just like flicking it? Because
that branches were a bit too large for that.
No, I mean, I've watched movies. There's no size too large
to flick something and have it explode.
I guess the problem was probably you didn't use liquid nitrogen because that's the trick.
Yeah. So we go about dismantling this entire tree. It takes like literally 10 minutes. And granted, it's freezing, pouring rain at this time, but it's a very amusing and weird thing. And so everyone's just kind of in a good mood ripping this tree apart. And I go and I rip off a branch, rip off another branch, and then I try to push the tree. And of course, it weighs like a billion pounds, so it's not going anywhere. So I back up and then just I'm standing there and sort of just casually reach over and pull on another branch. And I feel this weird twinge in my back. And I was like, that ain't right.
Describe this twinge.
One of those.
What's a twinge?
What is a twinge? That's a good question. Well, you blew out your back carrying a pressure washer.
I did. But I didn't feel anything at the time. Like I just carried it and it was fine. Mm-hmm. And then later I had like a creeping pain just slowly work its way across. So
actually,
maybe
it wasn't reaching for that. Maybe that's just when you started to notice.
I think that's what it was. I think it probably actually happened when I pushed on the tree.
Yeah.
And then it didn't show up until I just randomly was doing some other stuff about a minute or two later. And so my back just slowly kept on hurting. I was like, oh, that's not good. So I just stopped and then, you know, was hanging out. Everything got cleared away. I drove home.
At that moment, you're on the clock now.
Yeah. I was like, oh no, I need to get to a place.
Within half an hour, you are done.
Yep. Yeah. So that is exactly what happened. So I got home, went to bed. Woke up and basically couldn't bend. Just couldn't bend in the waist. So talking about cascading failures and the importance of keeping all your systems clean. There's one important note here, which is that my wife had to put my socks on for me. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
I also had noticed that I had a chip in my toenail the day before. Didn't take care of it.
It happens.
It happens. I was like, whatever. I'm the one who puts on my socks when the shit gets caught in here. It's fine. Whatever. I can deal with that. Next day, boom. Now my wife's struggling with a size 12 sock, wrestling it over my foot while I'm just laying there and then getting it stuck on
this toenail.
Chip. And I'm like, I have learned nothing from my DevOps preaching.
It's not even happening. It's the case that every problem that's your problem could become somebody else's problem.
Yeah.
In fact, it very well may be.
Yeah. And it will always be your future self's problem.
Yeah.
Who is just somebody else.
That's true. You know? Do it for future you. You know, take care of those toes. But so I convalesced basically for Saturday and Sunday. So I just didn't do anything. Laid on the day bed.
Except you did do one thing.
Used Game Pass on Xbox, which we've talked about a little bit here and there. And I was using it on Windows, enjoyed it a lot. And then, was playing on the Xbox. And it was just like, what? Because there's all these games that I've wanted to play for so long. Downloaded literally all of them and then just bopped around until I found one that I absolutely loved. So I played Untitled Goose Game. I played Human Fall Flat. I played Goat Simulator. There's all sorts of just goofy
stuff. There's a lot of games that you'd be like, I mean, I get it. It's hilarious. But I'll hold on to my cash.
Yeah.
You know? But if you already got it, you got it.
Basically every physics gimmick game.
Basically.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much.
And so, but then I ended
Gang
up,
Beasts. I'd pay for that.
Yeah. Gang Beasts is great. So then I ended up playing Children of Morta, which I think if you like Crashlands, because of the story aspect, if you like sort of what Crashlands does for crafting games, which is it puts a story on it. I think you would like what Children of Morta does for hack and slash games, which is put a story on it. The story is actually the main focus, and the total variety of animations and stuff is so lush and ridiculous. I'm just like, I don't even know how they had time to make a game.
But so you're saying it's a fun hack and slash game that has a story that is a bit deeper than there's demons.
Yes.
Hack then slash them.
No,
hack
there
then
are,
slash them.
There are demons, but you know, it's just that's what you get.
Yeah, but they're demons that have lives and backstories. Mm-hmm.
They got mortgages. They got children to feed. You know.
Speaking of demons, we actually killed Diablo a little while ago.
With
our hardcore mode. We played hardcore mode barbarians.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It was very easy.
Yeah.
So
it was fun.
Maybe next time, Diablo. okay. And then as far as studio news goes, so we're going to be updating our patch cycle.
In that it is essentially going to no longer be a cycle.
And in fact, was it ever? It was for a minute there. I think for 10 weeks we did a 1 week patch, which had its benefits. The big benefit was we got real fast feedback on pretty much everything, and then we were able to real fast respond to that feedback. Mm-hmm. So that was during the time where we had a bunch of sort of like half finished things laying around that we hadn't gotten into the game yet. So we were able to just like wrap those new up, items, shoot them out.
Yeah, you know? Sort of stuff.
Then we kind of hit that point where we're like, okay, we have a lot of bigger stuff that's going to take more time. So that was when we started doing like those UI rebuilds and web rebuilds and stuff. And we knew that if we were on a 1 week cycle, then we would like work on it Thursday, Friday, ditch it, pick up something on Monday, Tuesday to cram into the patch and release it, then go back and forth and back and forth. That's a bad move because it really generates a lot of errors and stuff. Cause
a lot of waste.
Yeah, you keep like picking up a project and dropping it. So we switched to that 2 week cycle. That was good. And then after a while, we're like, shit, we have some things that are going to take three
Even
weeks.
More time.
So then we made the announcement like, okay, we're going to be switching to this. I think we said like roughly a 4 week cycle, but some of them were three and some of them were five. So we never actually hit the one that we said. And that was good for a lot of those things, for getting those big things out. And now we're kind of in this odd space where we're actually doing a lot of invisible stuff.
Yes.
So we're going to be continuously like fixing bugs and making small improvements to the game. We're going to be developing some new systems like achievements UI and stuff like that. But we're developing these things in a way that we should pretty much be able to at various points just drop a patch on a Wednesday without like abandoning the thing. As long as we view the patch as like, this is just a bug fix patch. This has some improvements in it or whatever. We're working on some other features. They're not in this one yet.
Yeah, so basically we're just going to be chilling out about it. I think it's the easy way to put it.
Yeah.
When a patch is done, we'll put it out, and that's going to be how it is.
Yeah, well, not only that, but our previous approach was like we wanted to make sure every patch was a big deal. And because of that, that forced us to be in a position where like we kept having to drop a feature, quickly cut, like make something that is a big deal, put it in the patch, and get the patch out. If now we say, you know what, we're just going to patch as frequently as we can, but we're going to do it in such a way that is good for our – good for the game and good for our sort of like project workflow.
Well, it's mostly that we need to get ready for launch.
Yeah.
We are
in the final stretch.
Yeah. And so we have to be – we actually need to be trying to add as few new actual features as possible because we need to rapidly get to the point where we can be submitted to cert. We can have everything fully localized for realsies because literally every moment Seth spends touching the game code, he's adding new stuff.
Shoving words.
So there's almost 13,000 words in the game now.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Where did they go? Yeah. Where are they?
And we just added a jillion.
We put the presentations in.
Yeah.
Yep.
Not in a way that you get to experience, listener. But
That's the other thing is so we're developing a lot of these sort of like launch features where basically come launch, they're gonna get in there for the final patch. And right now they're just kind of all being developed all on their own. And in the process of developing those, we're also fixing bugs and doing some other stuff. And if we hit it like a point where like on Wednesday, it's like, hey, we fixed like 20 bugs this week while we were working on this other feature, we can just put that out. It's fine. We can just deploy that patch. It's no big deal. So we're going to try to get away from the big deal patch concept and just get stuff out when we can.
Yeah. Well, I think it's one of those things that's hard to appreciate outside the context of making games and trying to make a living doing it is that launch is a spectacularly complex affair if you're going to do it right. There's a whole bunch of like, there's a jillion dominoes coming like from every direction that all have to like fall into place at the right time. And you need to have a lot of sort of room to do that. And every time you add something new to the game, you're basically making it harder to juggle all the rest of it because you're adding uncertainty to the system. And not only that,
it needs to be tested and everything else.
And so not only that, but then, game developers, especially indies, which were just starting out, tend to think that all I gotta do, I just gotta get this game out. Just like once I can get there, then I'm fine, right? But if things go well, then that's when the trouble really starts, right? As the game is out now and suddenly you have, if things go well, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of players who now all want you to
do stuff.
They want you to fix things. They want you to change things, want you to fix things, want you to provide support.
Yeah. So what's your method? How are you handling customer support tickets?
If you barely scraped over the finish line, how the hell are you going to get back up and continue running for the rest of your natural life?
How are you going to deliver your inevitable, you know, Dave 2 patch, yep, because you discover a whole bunch of edge cases that now that you have enough users, you actually get to see happen, mm-hmm, in the wild. You
know? Now, I will say there is an easy answer to this question, which is crunch. This is how pretty much everybody handles it. And it's how we've done it in the past. It's how we don't want to do that anymore.
Yep.
And so we're trying to pre-develop systems to allow us to handle all these
novel
things.
Concept.
Yeah. Yeah. And so all those have an enormous cost to us in terms of just where our time has to go to develop all these things without anything visible happening to the game, because it's all making it so that once the game is actually delivered, we can now make a new content patch if we want to. We can now fix problems that come up. We can now handle the fact that we have a lot of players that we manage. We have to do with community management, moderation, and blah, blah, blah. It's just endless. And if we get all that done ahead of time, which nobody gets to see, it means that we get to do more for you later, you know?
So I think the way to think about it is early access level head is a caterpillar.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Level head is now in a cocoon.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. So there's going to be a lot of stuff happening under the surface that you're not going to see. Mm-hmm. The whole thing is going to liquefy.
Yep.
It's going to turn into a soup, but it's going to remember what it was. And it's going to emerge at launch with all kinds of spectacular colors, mm-hmm, features, and wacky shit that you didn't even know was coming.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then it's going to – then it can really go. Then mm-hmm, it can fly.
Mm-hmm. It can go. It can live on its own. It can cause hurricanes on the other side of the world.
Yeah. It's going to have mobile touch controls. It's going to have a new player experience. Amazing. Update. It's going to have all kinds of shit in there. Mm-hmm. You didn't even know. And then once that's in there, we get all the players we need. We get the support we need for the game. Then it's time to start getting more content in.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So we're cocooning. That's where we're at.
That's a good way to put it.
All right. And then also, speaking of launch prep, we sent out a dope PR email, which Sam was particularly proud of and just wanted to
share. Yeah, I think I peaked in terms of subject lines, which we ran some stats.
Peak dope.
Yeah. Yeah, so basically the purpose of this one was not actually – we didn't send anybody keys. We were just letting our huge list of people know, who we haven't talked to for a while, that the game is approaching its ready state, and so everyone needs to buckle up because they're going to be getting a code sometime in the next while.
These are all people who actually already have sent codes, I believe, right, in the past?
Not all of them, actually. Okay. Only a subset. And so some of them have heard of us during early access. Actually, probably half of them have not heard of us at all.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was just sort of wrap-up email that was, you know, just talking about how cool the game is, basically. But the subject line came from a bunch of stats that Adam had done on our player base, which I think we revealed some of them in one of the last 2019 episodes. But it was revealed that our players have died more than 3 million times on each other's levels.
Yeah.
And so
– who knows how many on our levels?
A lot more than that, because I think we hit that number.
Campaign? Yeah, the campaign. Oh,
yeah. I think probably the campaign hit that number within like a month or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, so my subject line was millions dead in level head, which as far as clickbait goes –
it rhymes. It's sensationalist.
Mm-hmm. Oh my god!
The whole
and it thing. Had the highest open rate of any press email we've ever sent. So yeah.
It was like a 60% in like the
more
first
more than that
in like the first hour or yeah, something.
I think I'll get the exact figure. I think it's above 75%, which is obscene.
Yeah. So normally it's like a week later we're looking at like a 5. Shit.
We did check to make sure that no disaster had occurred in the world.
I did.
Right, yes. Before sending it out because
– and we crossed our fingers and hoped that no disaster was happening right now as we were sending it.
Yep. It's always a risky run with the sensationalist.
Especially because disasters are happening all the time.
They really are.
They just won't stop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess it's kind of upsetting that you have to check and see if millions have died in the last week.
Before. Have millions died and I didn't hear about it? Let me quickly just right. check.
Why is that a thing? What? Good question.
The world is wacky. So we're just kind of cruising on that. We're cocooning. So we may actually have a patch out on Wednesday. I don't know. I mean, it may have like 3 bug fixes.
Who knows?
But who gives a shit? We'll just put it out. It's fine. No big deal.
It's fine.
All right. And then industry news. We got 2 quick things to talk about. 1, Rocket League. They dropped support for Mac.
They're fascinating.
They're just like Linux. They're just like, we're over it now. It's done.
Yeah, and their rationale was very vague. They didn't really explain why. The short of it was that they want to be able to introduce some new, unknown, undiscussed features that they cannot sort of see how to do and support on Mac and Linux, and which I assume means they're going to be integrating with some Epic platform stuff now that Epic owns the game. And that Epic is only developing those things for Windows. Is my bet. And so they're basically saying, well, we could now have like 2 different versions of the game, right? Or we can basically just completely roll back online support for those things. So they're going to release a final patch that just patches out online multiplayer, and they're going to allow refunds, but it's a big deal. And I was looking into this because then the people that were reporting about this were also talking about prior instances of it. The really big other one was Rust.
By
the Gary's Mod guy. Yeah. And so he dropped, I think he still has Mac support, but he dropped Linux support.
So it was that Mac is 2.5% of.
Yeah, so Macs, if you look at Steam's most recent, because they do a hardware survey, I think every month. Yeah. So if you look at December, 2.5% of Steam users are on Mac. 0.7% are on Linux.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so the question here is Windows. If you can get almost 97% of the player base with 1/3 of the platforms.
Yes. Which, again, as the complexity of your game goes up, that is a tremendous cost. That port is very expensive.
That porting, as we are seeing, getting level head on all these other platforms, it's a lot.
Yeah.
And it's even simple shit that you don't think about, like how they handle a controller.
Yep.
Like, oh, well, what if it's Y-flipped on one platform? Then it's like, okay, we got to go into code and make sure that our controller accounts for the fact that this platform Y-flips. Then it's like, oh, no. It turns out that kind of platform only Y-flips these brands of controller.
Yeah.
So you basically find these like thousands of tiny weird edge cases that you just don't think about.
And it's basically all to do with input output. So it's like also there's all this resolution wonkiness.
Oh, yes.
There's
screen display, getting things to work on full screen versus not. And
are we even putting Levelhead on Mac?
Was the plan.
So we've been working on it on Mac, and we've been deploying it and testing it and doing all this stuff. And there are so many things that we just can't seem to resolve to make it a good experience to match what we have on Windows, which isn't necessarily a Mac problem. It's very likely some combo of like Game Maker Mac stuff.
Yeah, but it's never really a platform problem, right? It's always because platforms are just different. That's their whole fucking thing, right?
Yeah,
it's that. In order to handle those differences, because there's not something wrong with Mac. It's just that Mac has almost zero market share, and so you have to decide, given all the things that are different about Mac, do I want to basically pay the enormous development cost? Because like the fact is, it would cost us if you look at all the cumulative time that it takes, and just like raw time, like dollars, like us. Paying wages kind of a thing. We're talking tens of thousands of dollars. Yeah,
To put it on Mac.
And now this is coming for this like tiny, tiny fraction of the audience, right?
On one of our platforms. One of our many platforms we're launching on, right?
Yeah. Doesn't really make any sense.
Yeah. So basically, you're talking spending weeks and weeks of work, testing, whatever, to potentially boost your player numbers by like a fraction of a percent overall. Yeah. Even a fraction.
Again, more importantly, increase the complexity of delivering any future patches to actually the majority of your players.
Yeah. So we're actually, after this came out, we're like, maybe we should take a second look at our Mac plan. Because it's also the case that, you know, if our goal is we want this game to be available just about everywhere. And so the idea should be like, if you're a person operating like as a gamer, meaning like you play games, then chances are you're going to have one of the kinds of screens that this game is on.
Yep.
You'll have a smartphone, you'll have a Nintendo Switch, you'll have an Xbox, you'll have a PC potentially. You'll have something that we can get it to you on.
Yeah. So, it is a little bit of a bummer because there's so many people I know who actually just have Macs, right? But it's weird because then you look at the numbers on like Steam and it's almost none of those people. So when it comes to the actual market that we're putting the game into – that's just the numbers aren't there. But I thought what is this? Is it Gary Newman? Is that what his name is?
The Rust guy.
Yeah. They approached it in a really interesting way. Because for the whole time that they had been producing this Linux version, they basically said they were doing it because they thought it was the right thing to do, which is that they wanted to support open source. They believed that that was important.
It's like spending a bunch of money on a charitable donation.
Exactly. Yeah.
We're supporting this community by spending a bunch of our time and money.
They wanted to serve that community and the whole thing. And they was framed that way the whole time. So they were always basically saying, look, we're just losing money on Linux. That's just what is happening. But at some point it became just so costly that they just couldn't justify it anymore, in particular because all like the anti-cheat features and that kind of stuff you can't do on that platform without – I guess you can't do without having to invent one yourself,
again,
right?
Yeah.
So it was like becoming a cheater haven, you know, that like if the people that were then coming from Linux were the ones responsible for too much cheating. Like there's all this stuff. They were just like, we don't want to – we just can't do this anymore. And so they basically put out a statement saying we're going to pull support for Linux, and they basically were very apologetic about it and said, you know, we just can't afford to support this. But they're going to do refunds for basically for anybody who just has played the game on Linux. So they were, and at the time, Steam couldn't do something like that. So apparently they were working with Steam because it's Gary Newman and he's made that platform $1 million and to have a mechanism where if they could just tell if you had ever played the game on Linux, right, in their recorded history. And so he put out a note. He's like, everybody, make sure you, if you're going to play, if you want that refund, make sure you boot the game up on Linux just in case it hasn't been recorded yet, right? Or it's like the last time was too long ago. And he's like, and even he encouraged people that even if you were actually satisfied, like you played the game, you feel like you got your money's worth, you should still ask for a refund anyway, and then use that to go buy a game that's fully supported on Linux. Because the idea of being again, that, yeah, he's yeah. like, he's like, mm-hmm. we do want to support that ecosystem. Right. It's just is becoming too unreasonable.
Well, for, this is where that crossroads comes from, being a business,
yeah,
or like operating like a business versus operating as like an artist or
yep.
you know, whatever.
Yeah, because I want the game on Linux because I want to play it on my own Linux machine. You know, like and
yeah, that would be cool.
Yeah, and I have friends who only have Macs at home, and I want them to play this game that we made, right? But from a business perspective, it becomes harder and harder to justify.
Yeah, the numbers always have to add up. If you push against the numbers and you're not in a position to do it, then the numbers will win. Right? Yeah. They just are what they are.
Yeah.
So let's also talk about Temtem.
Yeah.
What's Temtem? I don't
Temtem's
know.
Temtem's blown up. Temtem. It's a Pokemon MMO that's on Steam.
It's not Pokemon. It's
basically Pokemon.
It's a Pokemon clone.
Pokemon, yeah. But we'll say Pokemon inspired. I'm going to call it
yeah, but it isn't a Pokemon game. Not like
no, from it's not, that, not no, branded brand, as yeah. Pokemon.
So it's called Temtem. It was actually kickstarted, I think, a year ago, maybe 2 years ago.
I think I remember seeing a video clip a long time ago of it.
Yeah. So they basically, people have these cards instead of, you know, Pokeballs. They have these cards that you catch a creature in. You throw them out and it's like 2v2 battles and stuff like that. And apparently it's very – very good. It's been blown up on Steam, and the fact that it, of course, is MMO Pokemon, everyone's like, yes, we've always wanted this, for one. And two, apparently they did a few tweaks to the battle system to make it much more intense in the sense that like, you have to be playing on purpose in order to win instead of –
Does it have raids? No. I mean, it's MMO, so it's got to
– It should.
It's got raid bosses.
It's early access.
40-person Pokemon raid boss is going to be
– Yeah.
I imagine like – 40 people standing in a semicircle, all throwing their Pokemon out and then doing like one turn after.
That's actually how it works in the Pokemon Sword and Shield because they have raids in there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but there's just four people.
Everybody just takes turns. So the boss just stands there just getting the shit kicked out of it.
Well, it's also gigantic though. It's like a Godzilla creature basically.
Sure.
And then it's four people taking turns beating on it, which is kind of weird. But yeah, so it's blown up and it's been really cool to see a game like that. I think we've been talking about like what do you – you know, what makes a game really successful in that sort of, and that with that level of standout? I think they had their peak concurrent players on day two was like 30,000, 35,000.
Wild.
Insane. It's a $35 game. Like, it's not a free to play game.
Yeah, it's great.
Wild. And so clearly it's just like exploding. And so it's one of those questions which is like, okay, so whenever you see one of these, kind of like Stardew Valley, basically it's a game that's riffing on an existing game that is somehow filling a need, right? And I think the idea of MMO Pokemon is. I mean, like, people just say that to someone. Yeah. And like, yes.
Yeah, it's all you need.
Gimme.
I think ever since World of Warcraft entered the public consciousness and, like, that kind of took over in the mid-2000s, the dialogue around pretty much every major franchise is like, I want an MMO of this.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. And a Pokemon was no exception. Like, was a huge ask back then. And
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I never say never, but, like, based on what we've seen from the, what is it, the Pokemon Company? Is that what mm-hmm. they just called themselves now? There's not much to indicate that they would want to go down that road, but
yeah, they haven't invested in that kind of online.
Yeah. But maybe after seeing this, maybe they'd be like, oh shit. Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
Guess we got to do it.
But it's been fascinating to watch. So we'll just keep our eye on it, but, it's something to check out. At least go see the, little trailer. They did like an anime trailer mm-hmm. for it, which is super fun. So very cute. And again, it does look very much like Pokemon.
You know, I think Pokemon is kind of like Star Wars in that. There is no amount of content that could be made for that franchise correct. That would be too much for the audience.
100%.
Lunchboxes, underpants, just MMOs, anything.
10 games toys, a year.
It's all hats. Fun.
Yeah, I think really it's that Pokemon as a franchise has sort of created a scarcity that might be a little too scarce because right. now other people are actually capable of filling it, right?
Yeah.
Unlike Star Wars, which is like it fills those holes constantly, right? There's never a moment where there isn't some new Star Wars thing available that you can go. You know, get your hands on.
Yeah, you don't see very many other people being like, I made a movie about Space Wizards 2, and it's slightly different in its own way. You know, flock to that movie or whatever. Okay, well, that's interesting. I guess we'll see where that goes. Let's get on some questions. These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bizcatch.net. highest voted question comes from Mimabip Gorky, who says, do you set limits on how long you can spend cleaning code? I just spent an entire week refactoring 4 weeks worth of code, and now I feel bad about making no progress.
Well,
Adam has opinions about this.
I do have opinions about this. The first thing is that progress is not measured by lines of code created. If anything, it should be measured by lines of code deleted.
Yes.
So
what's the joke? There's one button on your keyboard that can make any code better.
Yep.
Delete.
Yeah. So I think there's a framing problem here, which is thinking of – this is the whole idea of also that features are the thing that matters, right?
Yes.
And
this is the state we're in with Levelhead.
Yeah.
Which is like we –
features are the things that you sell to people, right? But in order to sell that feature, you have to be able to support it.
You have to be able to deliver it.
To be able to deliver
and maintain it.
Yeah. And so all that behind the scenes stuff is it doesn't make any sense to say it's like just as important as or more important. It's just – it's required also, yes. Right? You need the feature and you need all the support underneath it.
It's part of the work is the important.
It's part of the work, yeah. It's not something that you just get to also do if you have time, right? Because if you treat it that way, then the end result would have been instead, yeah, you spent this 4 weeks writing this code and then you spent the next 4 weeks writing some other code, except that it took you 4 weeks instead of the two it would have taken otherwise mm-hmm. because you didn't spend that week refactoring things to make it easier to work with.
Well, right? This is just like off of our production conversation from two episodes ago, I think. We're talking about Blendy Fridays and mm-hmm. about how you just don't – you can never fully appreciate just how much you're being hit by the waste of having things set up badly, yep. having bad yeah. processes, having mm-hmm. awkward code that's hard to work in.
Yep.
Like you have no idea what kinds of features you wouldn't have been able to add to your game had you mm-hmm. not refactored yeah. that.
But the thing to worry about with refactoring is basically the premature refactoring.
Yes.
Because here's the thing. If you were to refactor the same code now versus like 5 weeks from now, you would end up doing it differently because the needs of the entire ecosystem at that point would be different, right? And so this is the same problem with premature optimization. Like I would because I think of refactoring and like having processes is just as optimization problems mm-hmm. in the same way that having good optimized code is. And so if you do that too early, you're going to end up having solved the wrong problem, which is just another form of waste. And so what I do for refactoring is I don't just go say like, I'm going to go refactor Rumpus, right?
First
of all, yeah, arbitrarily. Yeah. First of all, there's so many lines of code in there because I've been working on it for 2.5 years now or whatever, that is a crazy thing to even try to do, right? But I do decide sometimes, oh, I'm going to add another layer of – and even actually just last week, I added another layer to my type checking and because the entirety of Rumpus is built in Node, which is just JavaScript, and that's all loosey-goosey. You can do whatever you want, right? And so I've been slowly over time adding new requirements, which I just add with external tools that now just underline more things and are like, are you sure you meant to do this? You know?
Mm. So you just clean it up as you go.
Yeah, but it basically made it so that now like the entirety of my project is not basically now underlined in red, right? Like as in every file I open, there's anywhere between 10 and 50 lines of code
that are wrong.
That are now quote unquote wrong, right? Which basically just means really, things just, that I should go
loose.
I just need to clean them up. Yeah. I just need to annotate them better or whatever. But I'm not going through and doing the entire project, right?
No, I think again, it should be based on what your next need is. What are you working on right now?
Exactly. Yeah.
So you said, okay, I'm going to improve this next feature of the game. Yeah. What systems would that warrant a refactor on?
Yeah.
And then do that as opposed to just like arbitrarily being like, I'm going to go clean the whole code base because who gives, you know, like most code you probably don't actually need to clean.
That's no, because if you're not,
reality. It's working.
Yeah. If it's working for now and you're not going to touch it, you basically wait. You need just in time.
Yes.
You need just in time refactoring, right?
Use a pull system.
When you need the thing, refactor it. So what I do is basically that if I go into old code that I need to go work on now, the first thing I do is refactor it just enough that I can tell what the hell is going on, right?
So if the first thing that happens is you open it and you start squinting at it, and you're like,
yeah,
what?
Like that tree. What do you drive me?
What?
But don't go whole hog into it, right? Because there's a pretty good chance since you're in that code anyway that you're going to end up having to replace something, like add some new functions, like just like gut something, who knows? And so if you spend 5 hours refactoring it first and they're like, okay, now I'm going to go do what I came here to do – turns out you just deleted that entire thing and that was pointless, right? So the way that I kind of think about it is only focus on the stuff that you need to be focusing on. Refactor just enough to make sure that you can easily work with it so mm-hmm. you can understand what's happening.
In order to do
whatever the work is that needs to be done.
Yeah.
And it's only in extreme cases where you should like truly deeply refactor the thing. And that's basically – that actually happened to me yesterday because I was working on a system that was supposed to be easy and discovered that every time I made a change – that I thought was going to work, the surrounding system was so nightmarish that it didn't work. And so Yeah, so sometimes you run into that and then it's time to actually truly and deeply refactor. But yeah, you need to be careful with it.
This is why it's called spaghetti code, because every line of code is a noodle that's tangled up in a bunch of other noodles.
Yep.
And you can't just like – you can't get a noodle out of there without
touching all the
other noodles. Touching all the other noodles. They're all like mixed up in there.
Yep.
And plus it's got sauce all over it. Oh, and what's God. That meatball
well, you also don't want to – before you sit down to eat your spaghetti, you don't want to like pull out every noodle and line them up next to each other to get them all separated, right? Because mm-hmm. – Then you don't get to eat your spaghetti.
Now you're eating a raft made of noodles.
But this is why when you go into like – because when you go in to eat your spaghetti, what you do is you stick a fork in there and you kind of pull it up to kind of get just a few noodles. Yep. And then you roll them up to separate them. You just separate the ones that you need, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah. I think the problem with the spaghetti code metaphor is it describes what it looks like, but functionally it doesn't make any sense. Because you want spaghetti to be in like a big blob.
Yeah,
that's true. That's how you get it in your mouth good.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's one noodle after the other in a nice neat row, that's fucking weird.
Yeah.
Get that weird creep spaghetti off of my plate.
Creep spaghetti.
All right. Next question comes from Chelosis. What fraction of features you implement end up not being fun and get cut?
I'd say very few.
We don't really cut features so much as just iterate them into the
– Correct.
We think of fun as being a balance problem.
Generally, yeah.
Right. So like we have an enemy called the canoodle in Levelhead. Mm-hmm. It hasn't been cut. It's still in there.
It isn't.
But it's not in there in a way that you can experience.
You can't get it.
It's way too hard.
I could put it in there, but I won't.
Yeah. Sam could put it in the campaign levels if he wants to. Yeah,
just in a moment.
And it fully works. But what it does is horrifying. It's basically like an armored ball that has tentacle arms kind of sticking out of the side. And when it sees you, it whips its tentacle arms back and it slaps the ground, hurling itself at you at like light speed. So it sort of like body slams you.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the
end – If you survive.
And if you don't get killed by that, then at the end of its body slam, its back opens up, a cannon emerges, and then it shoots out a series of projectiles and arcs in a sequence.
Oh, yeah. I remember fighting this thing a long time ago.
So like a cannon pops out and it'll just be like choo, 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 and it can shoot – five of them. So like that whole
they're not homing at least.
They're not homing, but
they do
it
cover
may as well be.
Yeah, they do area of effect that covers like the entire stretch in front of it for
yeah. And so and so as those things so the whole area is destroyed and you can't jump on it because guess where those projectiles are coming out of? The top.
Yep.
So if you try to jump on it, you die. If you touch it from the sides, you also die. And if you're standing nearby, you're dead. So it could be argued.
Could be. Some would say.
That this enemy is not too fun. Hard. Mm-hmm. It's not fun. That doesn't mean that the concept isn't fun.
Right.
Like what if we removed the ground slap and the sequence of cannonball things and it's just like – it would just walk around. And
sometimes
it would
shoot something.
And it would just like, yeah, just shoot one thing. Straight up instead mm-hmm. of completely covering the entire fucking area like a nuclear bomb, mm-hmm. you know, then, you know, maybe we could work with that. Because now like you'd see the cannon open up as you're about to jump on it. You're like, oh, shit. And then you got to like juke out of the way and then mm-hmm. time it out.
Well, it's an interesting point about batch delivery here. Because actually we made the enemies all at once.
Yeah.
It's an important note. And the weirdest thing about working on Levelhead over the course of the last 2 years has been feeling out the evolution of the game in terms of what it feels like it's best to be in terms of a playing play style. And the reality is that the enemies all came online basically all at once, back to back to back, and also actually early on. So probably like what, month 8 through
before we had 12? The grappler.
We had period. Most all of them before the grappler?
Yeah.
Okay, so the first 6 months.
Where all you could do is jump on stuff, and then we had push blocks that you could like slide on the ground, but the grappler was not part of the game at all. That didn't exist.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the crazy thing about that is that the conception of the game at the time was also very different. And so these enemies, most of them are that we the reason we add, for example, the scrub and the ocula is because we realized that actually the enemies that we made tend to feel much more like bosses by default, even just when the little one, like a flip whip will just murder you. It'll just come up and just rip your face off.
Even the vac rats, because of their acceleration, are weirdly hard to land on.
Vac rats go flying all over. Like, it's crazy. And so we realized, okay, so we actually pushed it too far in a lot of ways for this initial batch of enemies.
Well, and we pushed it where we wanted, which was our design philosophy at the time, was enemies should try to stop you.
Yeah.
Right? So like,
and they should be interesting.
Yeah. So we were, like, we were looking.
Those are literally the two requirements.
Yeah. So we were looking at how a lot of other platformers handle their enemies. And a lot of them are basically just these kind of like boring ass mundane thing that you literally just like murder it on your way by.
We were kind of using Hollow Knight as inspiration in terms of like the enemies are all, they're just really interesting. They just do, and they don't do very much, but they just do a couple things.
Yeah. And of course, we made Crashlands, right? So every creature in Crashlands had its own unique attack style.
A couple of things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that was our original thinking.
But seemed like a good idea.
Yeah. But it is the case, like, that does create a gap, which is like, maybe every enemy, not every enemy has to be completely murderous.
Yes. So this is something I definitely want to address once we get out of launch, which is like maybe a first update or something. Add a few more of these sort of more demos, basically.
Yeah, get some more enemies in there. Get some more and you could have like a flying enemy that just like drops stuff.
Yeah,
like it's fine. It's easy. It's simple. It's like a blobfish basically. Yep.
But before we were like, oh, that's not enough. It needs to drop something that then morphs into a turret and then starts shooting you, no matter where you are.
Which, to our credit, we did put the blobfish in as a baseline enemy, which is. Mm-hmm. It is the staple, like, demo. It just goes back and forth, doesn't give a shit about anything. Doesn't care whether you're there, doesn't care whether you're not there.
Nope.
It's just having a good time. Mm-hmm. So instead of cutting features, it's more about just tweak it, rework it, find that balance. There's a place for the concept, but maybe you just got to adjust.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
All right, next question comes from Maximilio. Seems like absurdism is a big part of the theme and story for much of the Butterscotch IPs.
I take offense to this.
And I know that you all take
– How dare you?
I know that you all take inspiration from the similar The Behemoth. I guess it also helps with the design philosophy of not worrying about making things perfect and mostly just producing content quickly. Do you have any ideas about more serious topics and or themes that you would like to explore in future games? And what would those be? And what do you like so much about goofy absurdity?
I think the reality is that we want to be exploring serious topics just through a lens that is extremely engaging and fun to be around. So even in Crashlands, I mean, the main theme and the idea of Crashlands is that you're just a person. You're literally a trucker. You're not a galactic hero. You're just a trucker.
You're just trying to deliver your damn package.
You're just trying to do your damn job. And I think that's literally the core theme and the idea of that was how far could you push someone who's just doing, quote unquote, like a normal job to become something absolutely ridiculous just by virtue of circumstance, right? The reality is I think we do try to tackle some of these broader themes. In the case of Levelhead, the story's not in yet, but it is done. So I think the thing there is one, of course, always making fun of just corporate bureaucracy is a very good time.
Yes. We get some really good – we get some good shit in there.
Just sort of the hollowing out of the soul that it causes, I think is
it's turning everything into a number. It's we have such a great line in there that I would love to repeat, but I don't want to spoil
it.
But it's so fucking funny.
So there's plenty of stuff in there, and then on top of that, with Levelhead, a big part of the idea was how do you build in the case of the story, how do you build a theme that tries to make it good and okay for people to basically explore and be their creative self in this sort of corporate environment, right? Which really what it kind of comes down to at the end of the day.
But also outside of the story, I think it's important to think of what the impact that a game has just as because of what it is, right? And so that can be because of the story. So the story tells itself in a certain way that evokes certain kinds of feelings or thoughts about the world or whatever. That's one way to do it. But another way is to design an experience that causes – so in our case, we're trying to cause certain kinds of interactions between other human beings, right?
Correct.
We want to create a social tool that allows people to interact exclusively positively. Like that is the honest goal that we have with Levelhead, and we have this challenge here, which is how do you make something where people get to interact, just period,
where they can go in there and they get to have a good time,
right? Because that is not a design principle that you see in almost any online content of any sort anywhere, in games, but just anywhere. And that was a hard requirement for us because, we want to be able to make things that do not make the world a worse place than it is. Right? But even more than that, ideally that truly make social interactions better and give people avenues to express themselves and that kind of thing. And I don't think you need a story to do that.
No, you don't.
At all. And I don't think you even need And I think the fun thing about the absurdism and the glee and all that kind of stuff is that it provides the setting where we can force people, because of the setting, to not take themselves too seriously. Yes. Because the context doesn't take itself too seriously. And we can use that to elevate the overall mood, right? Mm-hmm. And social interaction that people end up having.
Yeah. A big part of Levelhead, I mean, the core design goal with it, beyond – so on the social side is, of course, delivering this ubiquitous positive experience. Mm-hmm. But on the play side is to really assist people in recognizing that they can, for example, design video games. Essentially what this is, yeah, right? It is a mass education tool for teaching to unlock people's potential for designing their own stuff. And it's the reason that absurdity is so powerful is exactly what you said, Adam, which is that it removes the feeling that this is serious business.
Yeah.
Because
you can mess up, it's fine.
You can mess up and it doesn't fucking matter because the tooltips are dumb, the creatures are goofy, the GR team's always smiling at you. Like, everything's just fine.
Everything's fine. Everything's fine in Levelhead.
Everything's fine. And you could go in there and explore and do whatever you want. So that's like, as far as the angle we're exploring here, I think it's really the fact that the absurdity allows you to enter a more open-minded play state with regard to whatever it is that we want to throw at you. So I think that's sort of why it's our tool in our toolkit.
Yeah, well, I think this is how our studio operates, which you can tell through the podcast, but you can tell through the email Sam talked about sending earlier. You can tell through all the stuff that we do that we present the studio in exactly that same way as well, right? We're externally, everything that we present is all about fun and not taking ourselves seriously, right? If you were to come in and work like in the studio, you would see that we're buckled down, like everyone's working our asses off all the time. And not in a way that like that we don't like, but but we're very serious about the work. We just don't take our – and we're actually – and I guess we take ourselves seriously as a company without being serious about it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
which is very confusing to people who –
Well, it's kind of that extra layer of like you can care about what you do and also be willing to make fun of it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, we're literally
and find the humor and the jokes and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone's cracking jokes all the time.
Yeah.
In the office.
Like it allows for that space, though, where now we actually all get to take our work really seriously. We get to make mistakes. We get to do all the things. Yeah, we get to do all the things that you know, modern companies are touting you need the ability to do. You need the ability to fail fast and to give people trust and all this kind of stuff.
You need psychological safety as a team so people can do weird stuff.
Right, exactly. If you couch all of that in absurdism and humor, then it actually gives people the space to have all of that because they actually – because the context makes it feel like that's all true, right? Like they can have that, and that while we wouldn't encourage somebody to like just fuck something up for no reason, it's now the understanding is there that if I do, shit, I better go tell somebody so we can get this fixed and nobody's going to be in trouble and it's fine, right? So I think there's – it's kind of like how sci-fi – is how people hide an enormous amount of conversation about how fucked up the world is today, right? 100%. And I think we use absurdism in the same way, which is – or not specifically that way, but it's the same idea of like we actually use that as a vehicle to manage things that are otherwise just more difficult to do.
Just takes the edge off.
Takes the edge off.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you can also – you can – if you look deep enough, you can pull a lesson out of pretty much anything, right? And I think one of the things like Sam said that we always hit on is this idea of like epic and fantastical things being driven by absolutely mundane principles, right? Yep. And so
– I mean in Levelhead, you're just a nameless employee.
You're an employee. Now think through the chain of events though, which is like, okay, we've been shipping stuff across the galaxy. It's too slow, right? Mm-hmm. We need to ship things faster. So we're just going to shoot packages at the speed of light at our customers, but we can't shoot it right at our customers
because they'll
die. So we'll shoot it near our customers. Okay, problem is it's just bad form to not get the package to them, right? Like they need it. They want it on their doorstep. So we got the – all right, we'll make some robots do it. Okay, the robots are too dumb. I guess what we'll do is – develop this entire program where we have people sign up to then develop elaborate obstacle courses with a whole fucking ecosystem around this thing and build an infinite number of ways to train these robots so that we can finally put that robot into a cannon and shoot it at the speed of light as well, right? And so the whole problem they're trying to solve here is like really nice if we could get our packages to our customers slightly faster. And then this entire chain of events sort of unravels out of it. That's what you see in Crash-Ins. That's like what Flop Rocket. Mm-hmm. Flop Rocket, the premise was, hey, we wanted to start a space program with the Bureau of Science. We want to start a space program But the only affordable real estate we could get for our launch pad was 5 kilometers deep inside of the middle of an asteroid.
Yep.
Real estate is very expensive in
space.
In B-Scott universe.
Yeah. The thing is, yeah, in space,
space is mostly nothing. So land is very expensive. Yeah.
And what they, and also what they say is like, you know, location is everything.
Yeah.
And some locations in space are very good and some are really bad.
Yeah. Being 5 kilometers inside of an asteroid is not the best.
It's not. And also like, where is that asteroid? Because if it's real far away, there's going to be real cheap, right?
But the nice thing is once you get into space, you can just go anywhere.
Yeah. And then of course, like, of course, You're just flying your rocket. You're having a great time. Every time you fly your rocket, a little person flies out of it. You don't think much about it. You fly your rocket around, fly your rocket. Finally, you get good enough and you build up enough investment shit, but you get to space. And then at the end, we rack up showing how many people you killed.
Heroes lost.
Heroes lost, right? Like we rack up the number of how many people you sacrificed to get that one person to space.
We still get screenshots.
The cost of progress.
People still send
screenshots. It's an emotional moment.
It is.
Yeah. The little rocket flies out. Heroes lost. It racks up. It's usually in the 500s or 600s. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And then it's like successful launches. Bling. One.
As you're drifting off into just empty space.
Yep. Yeah. And like, what was the point of that? Like, we're out of fuel. We're just floating out in space. But it's this heroic moment because like you achieved this huge thing and you threw hundreds of people to their deaths, you know. But it's all
kind of another flop rocket.
But it's all kind of couched in this like goofy. The whole point, like, what was even the point of it? There was no point. Yeah. And then we kind of like we pull references and threads back to that. So like if you go into the asteroid tunnels biome in Levelhead, it's actually meant to be like the inside of that that asteroid. Like it's why it's purple. And like. Some aspects of it were inspired by like how the space ducks look and things like that. And then that's also why one of the song tracks is named Heroes Lost in the asteroid tunnels biome and why it's like this really fucking eerie, just like ethereal kind of sweeping like
– it's spooky.
Hundreds of people have died kind of a song. So like, you know, if you look – closely at all the weird shit that we've done. There's a through line in there.
There's some darkness there.
And there's a lot of darkness on the on the underside of the
Well, I think the reality is that the humor allows you to do things that are extremely dark with people not blinking an eye, which is fun. It's very fun. So in the case like Crashlands, one of the first characters you meet in Crashlands just gets annihilated by Hugo.
Just explodes.
Just gets laser beamed and just – he's the only character that actually happens to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure in the whole thing.
Isn't that right?
There's a much darker storyline though with the blind guy, right? Somebody that like explodes themselves or something. And
That happens somewhere.
Blew himself up to keep you from doing something.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of just like real dark stuff, but it's all captioned goofy language and looks fun.
Yeah,
yeah. If you were to swap the theme, I think it's a fun part.
Quadrupus Rampage, right? Quadrupus Rampage. It's this like weird sort of godlike being who has basically. Mm-hmm. Mind controlled the entirety of underwater civilization,
and is sending them up to ascend to the land to try to take over.
Which is again terrible idea because these are water creatures.
They're not even going to work. Even if they make it up there, they'll just
die. It's a non-issue, right?
Non-issue.
It's not a problem. But now it is, you know.
Yeah, and I think you know you as a quadrupus, you know, you go down there with your weapons and stuff, and you just. You're just
murdering.
You're just murdering. It's actually, I had a conversation with
this. You're murdering mind-controlled beings. You have no choice.
Mm-hmm. I had a conversation with Sampy on the way into work about this. The irony of Batman, of like Bruce Wayne is this billionaire who has all the resources in the world to do all kinds of philanthropic things to help out his city. And instead, he's just like dressing up in armor and beating the shit out of people in the middle of the night. He's like, I'm cleaning up my city or whatever.
Yeah. It's well, some socioeconomic policy might do a better job.
Yeah.
In the long term of reducing crime rate.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And of course, like, but if you look at also like how was Batman portrayed up until very recently?
Yeah.
Like in this really campy, kind of like goofy, very colorful way. Like I still remember that clip from the Adam West Batman where he's carrying a giant bomb over his head and like –
running
like with his dumb costume on, like running, running around trying to get this bomb out of the city. So like you can hit some really weird commentary and some dark angles on life and on philosophy and stuff.
I don't know. I find if you hit people over the head with it just by being super direct about how dark some stuff is, I find it just doesn't work unless. I don't know. It feels like you have to have a whole lot more in place in order to make something like that actually land
Mm-hmm. Think about like Hellblade, like a sinuous sacrifice thing. A couple of the other games that, you know, they do tackle these really serious issues and they do it in a very dark way. But
that's
the,
too much for me.
It's too much. Yeah, like I'm not interested. Yeah.
I want to accidentally learn life lessons.
Yeah, so. And it's also the case, like even in the freaking opening scene of Levelhead, we talk about the derp and we have the chart on there that shows like, oh shit, our lawsuits are going way up mm-hmm. and our profits are going down. The implication there is a lot of people have died.
Yeah.
Right? Like the Bureau of Shipping has killed a lot of people.
Yeah.
And the big issue here is that's not good for business,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And so now it's time to train up these GR18s and stuff. But of course, we don't like just throw it out there in the open and beat you over the head with it. We turn it into like a commentary on corporate yeah. culture. But it's in there. So mm-hmm. and there's going to be a lot more of that in okay. Levelhead once we get the story revealed.
That's why suddenly 25% of the game is not localized.
Mm-hmm. Suddenly.
Many words have been added.
Many words yeah. have been added.
It's going to be fun.
Yes. So, all right. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. We'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Koster, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, just go to podcast.bscotch.net, where we have links to everything. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
Goodbye.